next up is Power Players.
Friends, it's Ken Watmore, host of PowerPlayersRadio.com. This week, we are going to listen to a recent gathering we had with Bob Belts. Dr. Bob Belts has been influential in many different films that you're familiar with, not the least of which is the series from the Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Prince Caspian, and Dawn Treader is coming soon. So we want you to get a chance to hear the talk that Bob did on media and its impact on our culture, especially from the film world. And it's about an hour-long show, so grab a chair and listen in. I think you'll enjoy this one with Dr. Bob Belts.
So thanks for coming. You're here, and I know a lot of you are brand new to Creative Forum. Never been here before, probably wondering, this doesn't really feel like just Bob Belts getting up and speaking. I was waiting for a little while, and when's this going to happen? Well, it's going to happen within moments, so we can all get excited about that. But I want to tell you what Creative Forum is about and why we do this. So I'll start by saying I'm Ken Watmore. I work with a local media ministry, 1615.tv. And our heart is to impact the world for Christ through media. We want to use radio, TV, film, and online broadcast to share Christ with the world. And we want to do it in radical ways through media, as long as we're staying within the context that Scripture allows us, and that's it. I'm not changing that. With that heart, it's one of the reasons that I reached out to Bob, because many of you know him and know his heart in that area, and he's had a real impact through the world of film, certainly with his relationship with the Anschutz group and some work on Amazing Grace and other films that you are aware of. And we wanted to hear him speak to the issue of media and its impact on our culture, and he has a specific line that he'll take with that, and we'll let him do that. I won't talk for him. But I will talk to the issue of Creative Forum, media, creative arts, and how we can utilize those things to impact the world and what we want to do with them, and why you see little papers on your table that have sign-ups and everything like that, and some of you may be interested and some of you won't. But I will tell you one of the things that we want to do from the Creative Forum side, it's an outreach from our ministry to reach into the creative community, find out how everybody can join together with the talents that God's given them in order that they can impact the kingdom outwardly with those same talents. We want to be sure that we get people together and help glue them in those purposes so that they can fulfill what God's given them as a gift to use and make a difference out there using the arts. Okay? That involves media, it involves painting and drama and music and, you know, you name it. You can go down the line. If there's anything specific to what you have an interest or a talent in, we would love to know that, and we'd love to hear about how you might want to get plugged in. So we've got a little sign-up thing on there. On that sign-up sheet, it's name, phone number, email, you know, the normal stuff. We'll send you out a newsletter. We don't spam your inbox or anything like that. We'll only tell you what's going on with our ministry and what's going on with Creative Forum and where we want you to go and how we want you to get involved. Or, better yet, how can we help you? How can we help you do whatever it is that you want to do for the kingdom in whatever way that is? And if it involves media and the creative arts, better still, because it's an area that we kind of have an affiliation with, and we can help facilitate your calling, at least, right? So that's what that's all about. We want to make sure that we give you an opportunity to plug in, and Creative Forum is set up to once a quarter, really, we'll have these bigger gatherings with Creative Forum, and we'll try and bring everybody together. We usually have a good speaker. You're going to be good, right?
Yeah, I was going to say tonight's the exception to that. So.
We have a good speaker. We want to be able to give you a little, you know, strengthening the body. We want to give you a little encouragement. We want to give you a little bit of reinforcement. We want to give you some directive. We want to make sure that we're driving the boat a little bit so that you can, you know, get out there and swim and do things that make a difference. That's what we're all about. And that's what you should be all about. The body of Christ should be about making a difference. And however that is, if it's creative arts or maybe it's getting your hands dirty involved in some ministry, you should be doing something. We just want to be a part of whatever it is that you're doing when it comes to the arts that we're involved in. So that's Creative Forum. So please sign your names up there and let us know what we can do to help you. That all said, I want to bring Bob Belts up. Many of you know Bob. Bob is now the senior pastor at Highline Community Church. And still involved in consulting with Anschutz and working in the film world for sure. I will tell you this, just so you guys know, and from me, I know that he's flooded with people that have screenplays and really good quality products out there that want to get into Hollywood. I would tell you, he probably doesn't have a lot of time to do that stuff, not because he wouldn't want to read every single one of the things, but if you've got those, maybe...
give them to Ken.
Give them to me.
That's it.
I'll read them, and I'll critique them and tell you what I know about nothing. So, Bob, we just appreciate you coming in.
Thank you. Take over.
When we get all done, I'm going to go through a little question and answer with the audience. If you have any questions, start thinking about those. I'll come out there. We'll ask them, and then when we're done with that, Bob has a book, a new book, Me and McCartney. You'll tell us a little bit about that, too. And he's going to be doing a book signing. There's plenty of books available for purchase if you don't already have one. And we'll have a little bit of fun with that as well. So
great.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Thank
you. Well, thanks for coming out tonight. A bunch of my friends came just in case nobody else did. So, because it's very lonely up here, you know, if you're the only one here. I want to pitch another book. How about this? My friend Nancy Ricks is here. And Nancy is a phenomenal photographer. And through the last number of years, she's also been, along with my wife, involved in working on behalf of the Dalits, who are the untouchables of India. And she had these amazing photographs that she's taken through the years, and she's taken that and woven it into a book with stories behind all that's happened. And I know she has a couple of copies here. So anyway, if you want lighthearted reading, you can buy Me and McCartney. And if you want something that actually makes a difference, get Nancy's book. No. Actually, I should probably segue off of that, because Me and McCartney is a story, and part of what I've discovered over the last number of years is something about the power of story. I'm really going to throw just a lot of information out. Again, I know that sort of at the heart of what we're together for tonight is the idea of the impact of media on culture. I'm really going to focus in on the world of film, because that obviously is where I've had my experience. But just, you know, I was thinking just in terms of the power of media and film, one of the projects that I've been very privileged and honored to work on is bringing C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia to the screen. And Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe was our first in that series. We've also done Prince Caspian, and are currently shooting in Australia the third in the series, which will be The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, that will release in theaters on December 10th of 2010. But just to give you the kind of the amazing power, and this is just one little slice of the media pie, but it's estimated that both theatrically and then on DVD, and DVDs getting passed around, that 500 million people have watched The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. Now, that's like, you know, not that, you know, I want to equate it in any way, shape, or form with perhaps like what Billy Graham does, but that's more people than Billy Graham has preached to in his entire lifetime in one film. It's gone into Muslim countries. It's gone, you know, huge opening premieres with everybody sort of dressed up like the characters in Tel Aviv, you know, and all around the world. And really with this redemptive story that kind of for a lot of people that didn't even know what it's about, seeing basically the redemptive work of Christ portrayed in a story form in the sacrifice and resurrection of Aslan. So I think we all know that media has a powerful impact and effect. We worked on the film Amazing Grace. Some of you knew I was going to just kind of introduce some of the things that we had done, but what I want to talk about a little bit tonight is some things that I discovered along the way about how much of an influence and an impact that media has in our world. A lot of this I began to discover. I really, by the way, just got dropped into this thing. I had no, I didn't start out saying, gee, I want to be in the film industry. I didn't go to school in that area. I didn't plot to get into that area. And really, simply, and a lot of it kind of with way, way back roots in Cherry Hills, what happened to me was because of a friendship with a businessman here in town named Phil Anschutz, when he decided that he wanted to do something in this space. He literally said that he looked at the influence of media in the world. He looked at generally what he saw was the negative influence of a lot of media in our culture. And he kept asking the question, why doesn't somebody do something about this? And as oftentimes happens when we ask questions like that, one morning he woke up and said, why don't
I do something about this? And it's really kind of a funny story because I was working for him, doing some consulting on some foundation projects that that he had going on. We talked a lot about media. We were doing a series of little commercials through a foundation called the Foundation for a Better Life, where he was using public service airtime and then having high-quality little commercials made on values like honesty and caring and compassion. You probably have seen some of these and maybe don't know where they came from, but we were developing these things and talking about media. And one day, he called me into his office and he stuck out a book at me and he said, "Would you read this book and tell me what you think, because I just bought a film company and they want to make a movie out of this." This is the first time I knew anything that he was even kind of thinking along these lines. And he said, "Here's my mission statement." And he had said, "I want to make films that are family friendly, that you can take your grandkids, your grandparents to. I want films that don't have gratuitous language, sex, or violence in them." And this was, you know, kind of the zone that he was trying to hit. And I went home and started reading this book, and it was just loaded with everything he didn't want to make. And it was my first introduction to the fact that in this arena, particularly in the Hollywood arena, that people sort of, they invent their own reality and then they actually believe it. So if you have a script called Apocalypse Now, and somebody has $100 million they want to invest in family films, suddenly Apocalypse Now has become a family film, and you really believe it's a family film. And so, you know, this was sort of what was happening here, because this book was everything he didn't want to do. And so, you know, I just wrote some notes, kind of a white paper, and I said, "Here's 10 reasons why you don't want to make this film, or if you make it, here's 10 things that really these guys need to change to fit your mission statement." And he read it and said, "Would you go out and meet with the writer and the producer and see if we can get this thing figured out?" And I got on an airplane, went to LA, and kind of that was the beginning of a decade for me, really, a decade where predominantly most of my time was spent working in the film industry, up until January, where I've kind of gone back more into church ministry, but I'm still working on some of this. So in that period of time, I really began to look at not only the power and impact on media that it has in the culture, but how did we get there? And I want to give you just a little brief history of film, and then I want to also talk a little bit about how historically people of faith have had a tremendous influence in this area, and then kind of what's happened. But really, film, it's interesting. A number of years ago, I ran across this quote from Andy Warhol. He said it in 1966. "It's the movies that have really been running things in America ever since they were invented. They show you what to do, how to do it, when to do it, how to feel about it, and how to look when you do it." Now, fascinatingly, this observation that really, from his perspective, in a sense, popular culture was what was shaping America, and film at this particular point in time was on the cutting edge of that. It's pretty interesting, because really film is a technology and a cultural phenomena that at the point in time when Warhol said this was really only about 60 years old. And you go back and look a little bit and at the history of the film industry, and really the technology that we now, shifting now, obviously, because we're into digital, but the technology of filmmaking really was invented around 1895, and the two kind of groups take credit for it. One in the United States, Thomas Edison and his people, and then in France there were two brothers, Lumiere brothers, that were also sort of racing to invent this technology. But the thing that really made film, you know, movies as we know it possible, was that in 1888, George Eastman had basically invented the celluloid film roll. And prior to this, you know, cameras where you put a piece of film in, you took a picture, you pulled the piece of film out, you put another. And so when Eastman developed, you know, this roll where you had all of these frames of films that sequentially were in place, what it enabled someone to do was to take pictures, rapid movement of, you know, of set of pictures that when they again were played or were rapidly viewed, it gave the illusion that that this was actually action taking place. I mean, you know, we probably don't think about the fact that the very thing we watch on the screen when we watch film is an illusion. It's not, it's a whole sequence of still photographs put together and rapidly run in front of us to give the illusion of actual motion. So really all of that technology dates back to the turn of the 19th century. In the early years, film was really an entertainment for the lower classes. And it primarily was played in machines like you see here on the screen called peep shows, where, again, you'd either crank or there would be a mechanism inside of there that would run, you know, the developed photographs by you rapidly and, again, you know, give you the experience of a moving picture, kind of where the word movies comes from. And but it was primarily focused on lower classes and found in what in those days were known as penny arcades. And so the early years of film really were targeted and primarily influenced the lower classes. That began to change when the technology to project those images, which again Thomas Edison is usually credited with, and where instead of going to see these little films in a penny arcade looking in a machine, suddenly there were actually buildings that were designated and where screens were established where people would come to actually see these moving pictures, and that cost you a nickel, and they were called Nickelodeons. And the first theater like this that was specifically designed to show movies and was opened in 1902 in Los Angeles, and within 3 years there were 10,000 theaters across America. That's how rapidly and explosive these early years were, and yet really they were very short little pieces of film that people were watching. A huge transition took place because in the early days, Hollywood was not where films were made. The film industry was centered in New Jersey, and the Edison Company, which was called the Motion Picture Patent Company, Edison had all of the rights to the technology to make films, and he had monopolized that. And it's interesting story because most of the exhibitors at that point in time were guys that came out of industries like the clothing industry and the shoe industry. Many of them, as we'll see in a little bit, came from were Eastern European Jews, and they began to realize that as long as Edison controlled the means of production of film, they were never going to make a lot of money. And consequently, since he had a patent on this and you had to play ball with him to make movies, they basically began to ask the question, how far can we get away from this guy and basically violate patent law and make our own movies? And the answer was, well, you know, you can't get much further away than California. And by the way, the sun shines there a lot of the time. And literally, in 1910, the first film, and it wasn't Great Train Robbery, by the way. I just showed that up there. The Great Train Robbery is sort of acknowledged as the first motion picture with a narrative story to it. It was shot in 1903, and Edison made that. It's 12 minutes long, and it tells a story, and many people would say that's the first film in terms of a storytelling film ever made, and I just threw that in there. 1903, by the way, someday I'm going to write a book about this, or we'll make a film about it or something. It was an amazing year, 1903. Wright Brothers, fly the first airplane, 1903. First movies made in 1903. Sigmund Freud began practicing psychotherapy in 1903, and the Harley brothers and Mr. Davidson made the first Harley Davidson in 1903. Sigmund Freud and Harley Davidson, two very different approaches to mental health, by the way. So anyway, so 1903, quite a year. But anyway, in 1910, then the first film was made in what we call Hollywood, and by 1911, 15 companies had set up shop there, and so this little piece of turf in the Los Angeles area called Hollywood really became the center of the film industry, and it began to have more of an influence on culture. By the 20s, film began to conquer the middle class. Prior to this, again, when it was sort of targeted as a lower class entertainment, middle and upper classes still, you know, believed that the only cultured entertainment was the theater, and they sort of looked down on film. But by the 20s, film began to be so widespread that it began not only to conquer the middle class, but the whole phenomena of movie stars and fame around the films and all this began to develop. And simultaneously, the moral state of film began to get pretty questionable. There was a lot of, you know, in the 20s, they began to introduce a lot more sexuality into films and a lot more violence. And consequently, one observer of Hollywood in those days has said that Hollywood during that time was a dreary industrial town controlled by hoodlums of enormous wealth, the ethical sense of a pack of jackals, and taste so degraded that it befouled everything it touched. Now, that's not a lot different than today, by the way, but it was 1920, but not, just kidding. Ironically, this sounds like something that, you know, somebody from the radical right or the religious right would have said, but it was this observation made by S.J. Perelman, who was a Hollywood screenwriter that actually won the Academy Award for writing Around the World in 80 Days. So, you know, again, the sense of what was happening there was that film was getting more powerful and the morality of film was really beginning to decline. And by the end of the 20s, the film industry was the fourth largest industry in America. So again, it began to have powerful influence. I'm going to come back to the 30s a little bit later, but let me fast forward to today and talk a little bit about what we know about the influence of particularly visual media in the lives of particularly, I think, our young people, our youth, our kids today. It's estimated that among today's kids, postmodern millennials, Gen Xers, Gen Ys, I've got a Gen Yer at home, so I watch this stuff happening. But let me give you the statistics here, and I this is something that really sort of struck me as someone coming out of ministry and getting engaged in this particular area. But if you have a let's say like my daughter has just had a child this year, and let's say that we'll make some presuppositions here. Let's say that child you took was engaged in church, youth group, whatever, but had, let's say, a 1 hour every week of solid spiritual content of which they were totally focused on and absorbing, and it was relevant, made sense to them, all of which are shaky presuppositions, by the way. But if your child had that exposure every week, like, you know, parents within churches do, by the time your child is 17 years old, they will have been exposed to 800 hours of spiritual input. It's estimated that in today's culture, that same child, by the time they're 17 years old, will have consumed 40,000 hours of visual media. Now, I got to tell you that those statistics are a little bit mind-boggling if you think about it. So that the overwhelming sort of mental input and influence that kids in this culture get is bombardment with visual media. By the way, prior to this, this statistic was based on, I think, something like kids consuming about 6 hours a day of visual media. And what research in the last couple of years have showed us, because some of these statistics really were pre-internet and the accessibility of visual media via computers these days, the fact that what they began to research and discover now is that really over the last few years, the number of hours that kids are consuming media really hasn't changed. But what has changed is that now kids are multitasking, and that in a six-hour period, at the average consumer of media is consuming 8.5 hours of media because they're multitasking. And some of you, you know, that have teens and young adults, you know this. I mean, they're, you know, they've got the computer on, YouTube might be here, maybe they're playing a game over here, they've got, you know, their iPod in, and so there's this bombardment of media that is a result. But amazing amount of media that's being consumed in our day and age. My son Baker, by the way, and he's kind of turned us onto this, but my son, you know, one day he just said, "Hey, Dad, you know, I just signed up for $8 on Netflix. I can download and stream onto my computer all the movies I want on a month." So literally, he could watch a movie every single night for $8 a month that he just picks up off of his computer and it downloads it. So accessibility to media and new media, which, again, I know a lot of you are more engaged in, it's changing the rules of the game, but it's only ramping up the amount of consumption that particularly the newer generations are consuming in the media area. During those 40,000 hours, by the way, it's estimated that that people will view 50,000 murders, that they will see 100,000 beers consumed, and the level of sort of sexual activity that will be viewed in that time frame is really almost beyond the ability to calculate. So, again, the average high school student goes to 50 movies a year at the theater, rents or downloads now at least 50 movies a year, and 90% of high school students communicate that their favorite leisure activity is going to the movies, and 92% of the religious high school kids, like Valor or whatever, communicate the same thing, that film is their favorite form of entertainment. So there's not a big difference between church kids and kids that aren't growing up in the church. They're all getting bombarded with media. Now, let me go to sort of my generation, and some of you are in that, some of you are younger, but not to let adults off the hook, because our drug of choice is television. And today's adult, the statistic is that today's adult watches an average, this is mind-boggling to me, by the way, that the average amount of television consumed by the average adult in America today is 6 hours a day. And if that statistic is true, that means that the average American will spend 15 years of their life sitting in front of a television set. Again, the numbers are mind-boggling. And by the way, it's kind of interesting because I've spoken on this different places around the country, and I used to tell the story. I said it's interesting because in Denver, and I think they're out of business now, but you remember when Soundtrack a couple of years ago had a huge advertising campaign in Denver, and it started out by saying the average American watches 6 hours of television a day. And then sort of the tagline came in, let's get it up to 7. And then they would advertise their television sets. So, I mean, this is a relatively well-known statistic. And, you know, I found this little image of a couple sitting there, you know, watching television. And, of course, what happens a couple of years, the picture looks more like this. And, you know, she's gone. And, you know, he's changed a bit by being a couch potato. But, again, it's just mind-boggling how much media is consumed in our country. I think about, you know, my job, in a sense, as a pastor, particularly with a call to a teaching ministry, which I have, you know, I'm trying to build into the lives of the body at Highline truth. I'm trying to build truth into their lives. I'm teaching God's Word, Scripture. There's a battle for our hearts and minds that goes on all the time. And I know that there's a certain percentage of people sitting there, they're going to get 1 hour of exposure to the Word on a Sunday morning. And, you know, the rest of the week, they're going to spend hour after hour in front of a television set. And frankly, that feels like a losing battle to me, apart from the fact that I know the Holy Spirit, you know, uses the Word. But again, just the numbers and the statistics, I think this is a huge battle that the church is fighting in these days. So, and then not only is the quantity kind of mind-boggling. But the other thing that you need to kind of get your hands around is the movie experience itself, particularly the film experience and particularly in the theater environment. Again, if you go back and remember what I said about presuppositions, you know, one of the fascinating things about being the guy up front giving the message is that you see the people out there, in theory, listening to the message, okay? And it's always kind of humbling because you've always got a few people falling asleep out there. And if you watch kids in a worship service, I'm telling you, you know, it's really interesting because they're not listening to anything you're saying in that particular environment. Generally, they're drawing pictures and doodling around and messing around. So the presumption that even the hour that they get is focused and that they're zeroed in is a stretch. But you go and sometime in a movie theater, and particularly if it's a film where a lot of kids are there, stop sometime and turn and watch the audience. And you will be amazed at how absolutely zeroed in kids are in a movie environment. I did this on Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. It was just kids were on the edge of their seats, just totally enthralled. And so you think about the movie experience. First of all, you know, you enter in to a semi-dark room. You sit in a very comfortable chair, which, by the way, again, is not always the case in churches. Cherry Hills has got some of the best because they have what? Theater seating, you know. But you know, generally, I mean, Highline, we've got wooden pews. They aren't exactly, you know, it probably helps keep people from falling asleep. But anyway, you're sitting in a comfortable seat. Now you've got stadium seating with an unobstructed view at a theater. Again, I periodically go to the back of the church and sit down. Half the time, people can't even see what's going on. You know, people's heads are in front of you and, you know, the church is, and again, Cherry Hills built amphitheater style because of that, but generally speaking, but in the movie experience, you're seating in a stadium seating, unobstructed view, lights go down, okay, music comes up, you have these amazing, you know, digital sound systems in theaters that are, again, the power of the sensory bombardment of the power, even of the sound, is incredible. And then these images come on the screen with perfect clarity, and a story is told, and that story normally just gets complete attention. And for 90 minutes to 2 hours, people are transfixed. It is almost hypnotic when you look at the environment that goes on. And something happens, and every writer of every screenplay absolutely counts upon the fact that this phenomena will take place, which is called the phenomena of suspended disbelief. And that is, in that environment, you open yourself up to the story. And it might be fantasy, you know, it might be something that is, you know, light years away from reality, but the mindset of a person sitting in that theater environment is one of suspended disbelief. There's an incredible openness to what is happening in the story. I would suggest in a church it's the opposite. You know, oftentimes in a church environment, people are sitting there saying, oh yeah, I'm not sure I believe a word you're saying here, you know. And so it's a totally different environment. But that experience is so powerful that back in the early days of film, Vladimir Lenin said that film is the most powerful tool for shaping the human mind ever invented. And by the way, he believed this enough that in every state of the Soviet Union in the 20s, they built high-tech film studios and began to produce films, propaganda films, to fuel the communist ideology. Ironically, today, many of the major film companies use those same studios to go overseas to be able to film because it's cheaper over there. But the origins of a lot of those studios in Eastern Europe really was that the communists understood the power of film and that it really shapes the human mind. David Putnam, that was the producer of Chariots of Fire, many other great films, made the observation that every film has within it an element of propaganda. Value systems are being communicated. I don't care what anyone says. You know, Samuel Goldwyn, who was one of the pioneers of the film industry, one time made the statement, he was, you know, kind of ridiculing the idea that you should make a movie that actually sent a message. And he said, if you want to send a message, use Western Union. You know, that film don't. But the reality is, every film sends a message. And I don't care how goofy it is or comic it is, it always communicates value system. And again, this is what our culture is being bombarded with. And so the impact's real simple. That film impacts what we think, it impacts what we do, it impacts how we feel. I used to have a graphic up here, it was outdated and I kind of dropped it, but I don't know if a couple of us might have seen the movie Fight Club, you know, and it was a brutal, violent movie, and I had an image of Fight Club up here because it was fascinating. One day I was there's this kind of society of anarchists, really, that kind of develop in the movie, and there's a name for it. Any of you guys remember the name? I'm spacing it. Oh, man. Anyway, whatever that organization was in the film, which again was kind of this anarchist group, people that watched the film started that organization in reality, in the culture. And one day I just happened to tumble onto something that pointed to their website, and I was blown away. It was a website that was telling you, dump dye in every fountain in your city, knock over mailboxes, all of this stuff. And it was this fictional organization that had been created in a film that people had taken and were now implementing, you know. And I mean, it was advocating violence. It was advocating murder. I mean, it was incredible, but it was all based in the influence that a film had had on the people that had seen it. So tremendous impact. And someone has made the observation, and I think we as a body of people in the faith community need to know that the movie theater, they said, is the church of the postmodern world. I think that's shifting. I think maybe the bedroom with the internet is the church of the postmodern world. But certainly, you get the point that media is really what is shaping the minds and hearts, not only of Americans, by the way. The other thing I think you realize pretty rapidly if you travel internationally is that a lot of people hate American politics, but love American pop culture. And the number one export of America is our pop culture. Everywhere you go, when we're in foreign countries, sometimes front page news is about Hollywood movie stars. It's crazy. I remember in 1988, I was in the Soviet Union, and this was before the wall came down. And I was over there with some guys from Campus Crusade, and I'd met a guy. We were just out really kind of, we had a couple of objectives. We were meeting with some pastors, underground pastors, and doing some teaching and stuff. But during the days, we just were trying to meet people, engage in conversation. And we were in Moscow, and we were in a park, and I started talking with this guy. And he said, "Oh, you've got to come to my house. You've got to come to my house." And I'm thinking, this probably isn't a good idea, but, you know, this is why we came here. And long short story, I got in a cab with this guy, and we went out to this kind of brutal tenement sort of a deal, which is where a lot of people live in Moscow. And I went in the building with him, went upstairs, and it was really, his spirit was hospitality. His wife was there, and they were going to serve me tea. But I remember walking in this guy's apartment, and in 1988, when you barely could even get into the Soviet Union, the guy's apartment, the walls were filled with movie posters. You know, I mean, this was his image, you know, of America, because this is what we export. So, you know, again, very important stuff. Well, where does the faith community tie into this? And let me take you back a little bit now to about the 1930s. So around the 1930s, film is, again, beginning to have tremendous influence on our culture. By the way, random statistic let me throw out, because I probably forget as we move along. But the peak year of film attendance was 1948, post-World War II. In 1948, 80% of American families went to the movies once a week. That was the statistic, 80%. Today, that statistic is less than 10%. of the American population goes to movies on a given weekend, but still the power that it has is way out of disproportionate to the fact that that's what's happening. But in the 30s, as this influence began to grow, actually, I won't go into this. Founding fathers, obviously, were non-religious Jews of Eastern European descent. There was no real religious motivation behind. They simply, it was a business for them. They began to make movies. Their morality was probably neutral at best. But what happened was in the 30s is that the church began to, people in the church began to realize, we need to get engaged in this because this is a force that's beginning to shape culture. And consequently, the Catholic Church developed an organization called the Legion of Decency. If you, any of you are Catholic by background and old like I am, I remember kids, my age, kids, that every week they got a newspaper, you know, from the Catholic Church, and in it, it told you what films you could go to and what films you couldn't go to, and it actually told you if certain theaters showed certain films, you could no longer, as a good Catholic, even go to that theater. But the Legion of Decency began to get engaged in Hollywood, and at the same time, the Protestants started an organization called the Protestant Film Commission. Now, a lot of people these days have very different opinions on these organizations, but let me tell you what happened there. Out of that, a deal was struck between the church and the film studios, and the deal was called the Production Code. And what the Production Code was an agreement between the film studios and the church as to what could and couldn't be shown in films on the screen. Now, if you hear people talk about it today in the film industry, it's, you know, it's like this, you know, this was the most horrid form of censorship, you know, imaginable. And, you know, and it's looked upon like, you know, something from the Stone Age. But I just want you to understand what was going on here. Sometimes it was called the Hays Code because the head of the Protestant Film Commission was a man by the name of Hays, and literally every script that a Hollywood studio was ready to green light and produce went to this commission to be read, critiqued, notes given back and forth, what was found to be objectionable, what that if you make the film and this is in it, we're not going to support you. And I think the important thing to understand is that the studios welcomed this. The reason was, and they were very smart guys, the reason was that the heads of studios wanted the people that were sitting in church pews on Sunday morning sitting in their theaters on Saturday night. And they knew for that to happen, they needed to play ball. Well, I mean, I'd never heard anything about this when, you know, we first started getting involved here, but the reality was that there was a tremendous influence on the film industry by the church. And out of that, ironically, some of the greatest films ever made were made under the Production Code. Some of these, and I just pulled some of these out as examples, but again, the ones in parentheses won the Academy Awards in those years, but it didn't stifle creativity, I promise you. I mean, again, some of the great stories and great films were made under this kind of a system. And obviously, the question is, well, what in the world happened? What happened where whatever influence people of faith had on this powerful industry, you know, vanished? And part of the answer is the 60s happened. And a couple of things happened in the 60s, but one was that the Legion of Decency shut down, basically, their offices in Hollywood and quit doing what they were doing. And in 1966, the Protestant Film Commission shut down their offices in Hollywood, and the rationale was they could no longer justify the expense to operate that office, and their annual budget was $35,000 a year. And basically, and I think there's a combination of factors here. One is I think that what began to happen created a reaction within the more conservative Christian community where Hollywood itself began to be viewed as evil, And basically, disengagement took place. And the result was, as someone observed, that Hollywood plummeted into the moral abyss. Part of what happened was that the production code was abandoned. And in its place, what was started is what we know today as the ratings system. And the huge difference is this, that the rating system is actually controlled by the Motion Picture Association of America. And originally, the board that rated films had seven members on it, and each of those seven members originally was appointed by one of the seven major studios. So that basically the studios now began to police themselves. And the result is, if you look at films prior to about 1966 and afterwards, you will see significant changes. And basically the impact was this incredible increase in violence, incredible increase in sex, incredible increase in crude language and behavior. And suddenly, under the production code, you could not portray a clergyman in a negative light or faith in a negative light. And suddenly it all flipped. And, you know, I can remember, I became a Christian in 1968. I was a movie guy. I've always been a movie guy. I've always loved the movies. I never remember seeing my faith after I came to Christ portrayed in a positive way in the movies for at least 30 years. And ironically, I think in 1965 or 6, Sound of Music, you know, won the Best Academy Award or whatever. And the only reason I put Clockwork Orange up here is because Clockwork Orange, I think, came out in 1967. And the tagline for the film, which I don't know if you can read it or not, on top of the poster, I think almost broadcast what had happened in the film industry in America, because the tagline to the film was, being the adventures of a young man whose principal interests are rape, ultraviolence, and Beethoven. And so within a 2-year period, you've basically gone from Sound of Music to Clockwork Orange. And that's what happened. And the final thing that happened, ironically, is that box office just plummeted. And one of the things that's happened in the last few years, and really the last few years, there has been an increase in family-friendly. There's almost a polarization taking place. The junk gets worse, but at least the doors have been a little bit open, because they began to realize, you know, they were just losing money. And again, from now, TV comes in here, you know, in the 50s, so that plays an influence. But really, you know, the box office. Result at the box office, a lot of it was that people just quit going to movies. And I bet there's many of you in this room that would probably say to me, I just don't go to the movies anymore. And that's true all across America. And that's why now, when people that are trying to get back in the game and make a difference, it is very difficult to get films made that have positive moral, spiritual content, and when they do get made, the big challenge now is that this lost audience, trying to get them to come back and support what's happening. And it's happened a couple of times. It happened with The Passion, was the biggie, which everybody thought was going to sort of change the rules of the game, and it did for about 15 minutes. And suddenly, whoa, you know, it could, because again, the dollar signs, ka-ching, 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 started going off all across Hollywood. And it was like, hey, you know, there's an audience out there for this. Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe sort of reinforced that, because again, it did phenomenally well. But a lot of films have not done very well that have been family friendly, faith friendly, and really that generally speaking, the producers have been unable to get the faith community to support. But as the impact. Hollywood Today, I'm almost done here, and then we can kind of field some questions. This is our neighbor, our old neighbor who's now gone up the road, Hunter Thompson. But, you know, he made the observation about Hollywood. He said this, the film business is a cruel and shallow money trench, a long plastic hallway where thieves and pimps run free and good men die like dogs. There's also a negative side. Hunter Thompson, anyway. That's a little bit of what it's like. So, anyway, let me blow through this real quickly. What is the media message? And I'm going to say this is not something I created. This is something I found in an analysis that somebody had done of the industry. And you might not totally agree, but generally speaking, with some exceptions, what is the general message that the film community sends to the world? A bunch of them. Romantic love, sex, money, and power are the highest goals in life. Premarital and extramarital sex is normal, frequent, and okay, and is without consequences. Rebellion and disrespect is normal, frequent, and okay. Crude language and behavior is normal, frequent, and okay. Smoking, drinking, and recreational drug use is normal, frequent, and okay. Romantic love is real love. Hollywood stars and rock musicians have the answers, which is an amazing joke if you know any of them. Religious people are kooks. God either doesn't exist or the God who exists is some impersonal force or more of an Eastern force, but either way, God is irrelevant. And generally speaking, all of those things is what media today sends the message that's in the films. What can be done? Is there hope? And I think the answer is, yeah, I think there is hope for Hollywood. And I think that people are trying to do some things there. It is really, really hard. 95% of every film you see is controlled by a major studio. Only 5% of the films that ever make it to the screen are independent productions. The average film today in terms of budget average, and I know guys in the room are doing some stuff that's very innovative, unique, much cheaper, but the average Hollywood film costs $50 million to produce and $50 million to market. So the average film costs $100 million. And basically requires about at least $100 million box office to even begin to break even if the rest of the auxiliary streams of income match the box office. So, for instance, this last weekend, A Christmas Carol just came out with Jim Carrey, Robert Zemeckis, great filmmaker. I haven't seen it, but I did read this morning that it cost them $200 million to produce the film. They figure, based on opening weekend box office, that it probably will lose about $100 million. And 9 out of 10 Hollywood films lose major money like that. And filmmakers and studios and producers are banking on, if they make 10 films, one will do so well it'll make up for the losses of the other 9. But 9 out of every 10 films lose a lot of money. And part of the problem is there, so far to date, are not a lot. Let me put it this way. People whose agenda is much different than the agenda of people of faith are much more willing to risk a lot of money in this arena than people of faith seem to have been. And that's why there aren't more films that carry our value system. But I do think there's hope, and I think people are trying to do some stuff. What should I do? And this is just a couple of ideas. Number one, I'll tell you what doesn't work in influencing this area. One is isolation. Historically, again, there was a point in time where, at least within the conservative Christian community, you can't go to movies. And in many conservative churches, some of you probably grew up in them, you actually signed a card to join the church that you wouldn't dance, drink, play cards, go to movies, and I can't remember. Usually there was a fifth thing. But what's that? I didn't hear what she...
Mixed bathing.
Oh, mixed bathing. Okay. Only you would know that, Sandra. I don't know what's a... Yeah, all right. Anyway, that's great. It sort of keeps, maybe it kind of keeps the church pure, but it doesn't change the culture, and it generally hasn't worked. The opposite of that's internalization, which is just sort of to kind of go with the flow, and you become part of the crowd, and you allow the message of the film industry, television, whatsoever, to just sort of, slowly influence you like the frog in the kettle. That hasn't worked. And then the third thing that really doesn't work is intimidation. And by that, I mean boycotts, cursing the darkness. We're good at that, by the way, in the faith community. And Hollywood, I promise you, loves nothing more than a boycott, because it just makes box office skyrocket. And so the idea is, if cursing the darkness doesn't work, let's start, how do we light a candle in the midst of it? And I think there's a couple of ways you influence. One is, I do think it's important in a media culture to be informed, and to kind of be aware of what's going on, to know, just kind of to, be media savvy, I think is a good way perhaps of saying it. And I think all of us ought to be tuned in to the culture. A second possibility is what I call investigate. There are ministries that really their primary focus is to interact with culture, media, and let you know what's going on. Movie Guide is a good one. Probably some of you are familiar with that. Movie Guide is a Christian organization. They do a couple of things that I think are really good. Number one, they are the only organization that puts on a relatively major awards banquet, kind of like a mini Academy Awards for faith and family-friendly films every year. And they really get, most of the major studio people will be at that deal. It's not like the Academy Awards. It's a much smaller little thing, but at least they're trying to do something that lifts awareness and rewards people that are trying to do something. The other thing is they view every film that gets released and run it through a grid of about 200 pieces of criteria, and on the basis of that do a pretty good analysis and then simplify that for the consumer. But on their website or in their magazine that comes out, they'll give you a rating on the quality of the film, and then a rating on the value system of the film, and they'll be very specific. Focus on the Family has a pretty good site, an online site for parents to be able to go in, and your kids are going to go see a film. You really need to know what's in the film, and if nothing else, to be able to interface and interact and talk through some of these things, because there's tremendous opportunities I think that films give in that area. But so some are called to investigate, some are called to invest. And again, we were talking earlier, like right now, I can't even tell you, I'm working with a group of guys that are trying to get The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis made into a film. And golly, there's just no funding. It's just like, the economic climate has so evaporated. Now, if you have a movie about, college co-eds running around in their underwear with a chainsaw dude cutting limbs and heads off, you can get funding, But if you want to make one of the greatest stories ever told by one of the greatest authors ever told with a faith message, it's very hard to find funding. And that's because not enough, in my opinion, not enough people with capacity in the Christian community are either care about this or are willing to, invest and try and make a difference. Grateful for those that are. And then finally, whoa, I want to go back here. Finally, some are called what I would call to invade. And I think it's interesting to me, particularly in the early days where I was going to L.A. just once a month, I guess, I would come home, I'd tell Allison, every time I would have some sort of what I felt like was a divine encounter, I'd run into somebody and they were there because they felt like God had really called them to be there to try and make a difference. And so, there are people there that feel this sense of call to make a difference. And particularly, I think this new generation that sort of is coming up in a media savvy world where, 80% of all short films being made and viewed on YouTube are being created on phones. We have a whole generation that are all movie producers, And the good news is that hopefully some really great creative people. I really think if someone is really, really good, and if I were to give somebody advice, if a kid was really called that way and had a passion and a heart and could get into UCLA or USC or NYU, or I guess Montana State's pretty good too, but I mean, if they could cultivate their craft and reach a level of excellence, they will get work. I mean, I really think that's true. I think that real talent gets discovered, and some people are called. And And I think that the more that we see of that, hopefully, hopefully we will make a difference. One final idea, I was going to just kind of say this, because again, I think this is one of those deals. I spoke about 3 weeks ago to a group of media professionals, a friend, actually another Cherry Hills guy. I mean, these were guys primarily in television and cable TV and some other things, but again, guys that are really committed to Christ in the industry, trying to make a difference somehow. And I think that this is a giant, you know, in the land. There's no question about it. And it is a deal that I think looks impossible. And it can be very discouraging, to say the devil's won this battle. Let's move on to something else. And I don't think that's the way God calls us to operate. But it does seem monumental until you realize, you know, it's very interesting what it really takes to make it. It takes less to make a significant difference, I think, than sometimes we think. And the image that comes to my mind is we were doing. A few years back, we did a film called Sahara that was just a fun little film that because some people involved in our company were big Clive Cussler fans, they wanted to make the film. And I'd never actually read a Clive Cussler book. And I picked up Atlantis Found. And I'm not recommending this at all. This is just a concept. And the book, the concept in the book is that... let me see if I can remember how to describe this real briefly, but sort of like they've cloned Hitler and all of these sort of offspring of former Nazis or whatever have all have this plot to take over the world. And the way they've decided to take over the world is that they are going to, they're building this tunnel in Antarctica that is going to break off the Ross ice shelf, which, by the way, the global warming guys say we're going to do it anyway. But and because they know that if they can break off this massive part of Antarctica, the effect is that it's literally going to shift the Earth's axis like 1 degree. And if the Earth's axis is shifted only this 1 degree, the continents, all of humanity is going to be wiped out. The continents will be covered with water. And they've built these cities, these boat cities that they're all going to live on and take over the world. Now, I just, you know, it's really a bad book, I know. But here's the thing I thought about. First of all, kind of one of the ideas on it is that we know that, like, you know, scientists tell us like 65 million years ago, a meteor hit the planet. And if that is accurate and happened, and that somehow it shifted the Earth's axis and everything just totally changed. And scientists tell us it's just a matter of time till that's going to happen again. You know, I mean, scientists believe the world's going to end much more than Christians do. It's just their timing is a lot different because inevitably, everybody thinks we're going to take another hit, and what's going to happen is it'll shift the axis of the Earth enough that everything will get annihilated. Well, the point being this, culture has an axis, and we tend to look at culture and think, I've got to turn it 180 degrees to change things, and it's impossible. And it is impossible. But the reality is, we don't have to change it 180 degrees. We only have to change it, you know, maybe 5 degrees. And if we can keep sort of hammering away at the deal, eventually it is very possible that we can shift the cultural axis just enough to really make a difference and change things. And I think that's the hope of, media and popular culture in our day, is that God raises up men and women who are both creatives and investors and have a vision and are willing to keep hammering away at what looks like an impossibility. And I think there's hope. And, I'm grateful that in some tiny little, way, I, for whatever reason, have been able to be a part of that. And hopefully will continue to be. But anyway, that's the way I think this thing works. So.